Me!
This is what you hear at the website savethewords.org.
Hello?
Roll your cursor over the homepage, and you will hear one voice after another imploring you.
Choose me! Yo! Pick me!
The homepage is a patchwork of signs and labels, each one displaying a single word. And not just any word, obscure words, words in such disuse that they have been bounced from the dictionaries. Maybe that's because we don't need a word anymore for having the qualities of a gentleman, which is, of course, squiriferous, or having the qualities of a shrub, frutescent. Or maybe it's just that in making way for new words like blog and bromance, staycation and chillax, we use up the lexicological shelf space that used to accommodate words like assectation, following something else, or drolic, which describes puppet shows. These old, endangered words, and there are dozens like them, are on the SaveTheWords.org website, where they are available for adoption. You sign up for a word, and you promise to use it in conversation and correspondence as frequently as possible. Edward Ong is one of the people behind this. Mr. Ong is a creative director at Young & Rubicam Advertising Agency in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Y&R designed the ad campaign for the print edition of the Oxford English Dictionary for Malaysia and Singapore. We querulated him earlier about his motives.
One of the problems we were facing is that many people prefer to use the online dictionary. So we thought, why not get them to cultivate a love for words and then push them back to the physical dictionary that they were using?
Yes, he's in it for the money. He's a philargist. And it turned out that the very success of the website was absolutely beautifying.
The next thing we know, that the site kept crashing, and we were wondering, what in the world? We found that a lot of people have adopted it, a lot of bloggers have used it, a lot of people are talking about it.
Proof that words that may not be common, but aren't vapis either, just might prove plebicular in the end.
Hello? Yo, pick me!
Me!
Yo!
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Nora Ephron was born to tell stories. She was raised in Beverly Hills, the daughter of New York playwrights who'd moved west to write screenplays. Screenplays for the likes of Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. As an adult, Nora Ephron worked as a journalist, and then, of course, she made her own name in the movies, writing When Harry Met Sally and directing her scripts like Sleepless in Seattle. More recently, the 69-year-old Ephron, and we're saying her name because it matters here, has been sharing reflections on aging. First in her book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, and now in a new collection called I Remember Nothing. In it, Nora Ephron spins stories on a mix of subjects, surviving divorce, egg white omelets, and most especially, memory loss. Here, she reads from the book's opening lines.
I have been forgetting things for years, at least since I was in my 30s. I know this because I wrote something about it at the time. I have proof. Of course, I can't remember exactly where I wrote about it or when, but I could probably hunt it up if I had to.
But there's a strategy you've adopted, you write, that I quite admire, which is that you have a whole other list of things you're simply refusing to know anything about so that you don't really have to even remember them in the first place.
Well, I think when you get older, things come along that you know are a test in some way of your ability to stay with it, right? And when email came along, I was just going to fall in love with it, and I did. I can't believe it now. It's like one of those ex-husbands that you think, what was I thinking at the time? Anyway, the point is that you can kind of keep up for a while, and then suddenly something comes along and you think, I give up. I am never going to tweet. I'm just never going to.
Read the list of the things that you're refusing to know anything about at this point.
The former Soviet republics, the Kardashians, Twitter, All Housewives, Survivors, American Idols, and Bachelors, Karzai's brother, soccer, Monkfish, Jay-Z, every drink invented since the Cosmopolitan, especially the drink made with crushed mint leaves. You know the one.
And when I read this, I was like, I know it, but I don't know the name of it.
Yes, we're saved somewhat by Google because you can, when you are all sitting around the table desperately snapping your fingers in the hopes of remembering the name of that movie that you can't remember the name of, you can make people think that you are not as old as you actually are because you have the technology to find the answer.
And you, on that drink with the crushed mint leaves.
Yes, a quick Google. The mojito.
Exactly. One of your chapters is about flops. Now, it would seem that you haven't had any flops to the average person who knows about your
yes.
work, but you have had flops.
Sure.
You write that flops stay with you in the way that successes never do. How so?
Well, I think that, and I think this is true, by the way, not just of the kind of flops that I'm writing about, but you know, romantic failures, the ends of friendships, these things take up space in your head because it is so possible to lie awake thinking, what should I have done differently? This is one of the reasons why Ambien is one of the greatest inventions known to man, because at least it stops you thinking about that stuff.
Would you read for us the very end of this chapter on flops?
Yes, happy to read this.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I believe every word of this. Okay. By the way, there are people who have positive things to say about flops. They write books about success through failure and the power of failure. Failure, they say, is a growth experience. You learn from failure. I wish that were true. It seems to me that the main thing you learn from a failure is that it's entirely possible you will have another failure.
But your religion, you say, is get over it.
Yes, absolutely. My religion is get over it, and I was raised in that religion. That was the religion of my home. My mother saying, everything is copy, everything is material, someday you will think this is funny. My parents never said, oh, you poor thing. It was work through it, get to the other side, turn it into something, and it worked with me.
How do you make that sadness, even though it stays with you, also quite funny?
Well, I don't know. If you have parents who are not interested remotely in anything but a funny story, you kind of grow up thinking, can I find a way to? And, you know, I think in some way my mother was teaching me a very fundamental lesson of humor, which is if you slip on a banana peel, people laugh at you. But if you tell people you slipped on a banana peel, it's your joke. And you're the hero of the joke because you're telling the story. So I think that it was a great lesson.
You know, though, for all the wit and the jokes that you have about getting old, the last chapter is titled The O Word, Old, obviously. And it, in fact, has an elegiac quality, a wistful quality. It suggests quite a clear vision of loss.
Well, I think that, you know, we've all gotten to the point where we work out and we dye our hair and we don't look as old as we are, but you do get to a certain point in life where you have to realistically, I think, understand that the days are getting shorter and you can't put things off thinking you'll get to them someday. If you really want to do them, you better do them. There's simply too many people getting sick, and sooner or later you will. So I'm very much a believer in knowing what it is that you love doing so that you can do a great deal of it. You know, when my close friend died, you know, we always sit around and play the game, what would your last meal be? You know, and it's like this fun game where you go around the table and everybody says what it would be. Mine happens to be a Nate and Al's hot dog. I mention this to you because you are in California and you could go get one right now. But Judy was dying of throat cancer. And she said, I can't even have my last meal. And that's what you have to know is if you're serious about it, have it now. Have it tonight. Have it all the time so that when you're lying on your deathbed, you're not thinking, oh, I should have had more Nate and Al's hot dogs.
Nora Ephron, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. This was fun.
Nora Ephron's new book is called I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. And you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. For many people facing foreclosure, the idea of getting a bank to modify a home loan seems a long shot. On average, only about 10% of those who ask for a modification succeed in getting one. And many housing advocates complain the process is broken. But NPR's Yuki Noguchi found some owners refuse to lose hope even when time is running out.
One of the people who still feel optimistic about loan modifications is Isabel Walker.
I have done a lot of last-ditch efforts at the 11th hour.
This Springfield, Missouri realtor and her business partner Todd Thomas go door-to-door offering salvation for those who are within days of losing their home to foreclosure.
He's here. Yes, Mr. Bonham? Hi, this is Isabel Walker. I have a brochure that I was given out for homeowners with options for foreclosure.
They spend 20 hours a week offering their help for free. Still, going door to door is a tough sell, even if they aren't actually selling anything. Because homeowners facing foreclosure seldom answer mail, phone calls, or even their front door. When they do find the homeowners, they're often testy.
I've had people that be near violent.
We always go out together.
It's safer.
Yeah, it's safer because, so, you know, I've gone to them by myself before, but you never know the reaction you're going to get from the homeowner.
On this day, even when they see two cars parked in the driveway, no one answers. Sometimes there's a security camera, and one gets the sense a homeowner might be silently peering out, suspicious that anyone at the door might be trying to evict them. Walker and Thomas drive on to the next house.
Is that it?
Oh,
okay.
No,
yep, that's it. They're 24, 26.
24,
Some
14.
Have moved out already. Many have already asked their lender for a modification on their loan, were denied, and are skeptical about the realtor's offer of help. Many people are denied modifications, Walker believes, simply because the paperwork requirements are such a challenge. There are so many documents, and even tiny mistakes can get an application rejected.
The house next door to it has foreclosure stickers on it.
Isabel Walker has a long and personal history fighting foreclosure. 2 decades ago, she was nearly evicted from a home after its previous owner sold it to her without disclosing he'd been through foreclosure. As a newcomer to Springfield, she had few resources, but fought back successfully.
You know, it's personal, and it's embarrassing, and you get emotional, and you know, it can cause you to make you physically ill.
That feeling is familiar to Sonia Finley, who tried earlier this year to get her bank to modify her loan because she'd gotten behind on her bills.
They don't want to hear that, and you don't want to have to say it to them.
She figured she'd already lost the battle. And that's where things stood on the Saturday before Halloween when she answered the door to find Walker offering her a brochure. Having confronted foreclosure scams before and having been denied once for a loan modification, she nearly threw it away. But the weekend ended, and she found out on Monday morning that her house was up for sale at a foreclosure auction in 2 days. She picked up the phone to call Walker.
When I finally made the call Monday morning, it was of desperation.
At 8:30 a.m. on Wednesday, just 2 hours before the scheduled sale, Finley's lender, U.S. Bank, gave her a 7-day grace period. Just enough time, Finley hopes, to push through a last-minute modification.
I'm very, very stressed. I'm not sleeping much. I'm not eating much. I'm just trying to take it one day at a time.
Finley says she's hopeful, though there's little time left. The next sale date for her home is scheduled for 11 a.m. tomorrow. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
After talking with journalist Robin Fields about her investigation into the quality of care at dialysis centers and the costs of treatment, we called Dr. Barry Straub. He's the chief medical officer of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and director of the Office of Clinical Standards and Quality for Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare pays for dialysis and related drugs for patients with kidney failure and enforces quality standards at dialysis centers. Robin Fields describes this program as the nation's most ambitious experiment in universal health care. Dr. Straub, welcome to Fresh Air. So let me just recap something that Robin Fields says in her article. She says that although some clinics are orderly and expert, others are run like factories. At some clinics, blood is encrusted in the folds of patients' treatment chairs or spattered on the walls, floors, or ceiling tiles. Hundreds of clinics have been cited for infection control breaches that exposed patients to hepatitis, staph, TB, and HIV. And she says clinics are supposed to be inspected once every 3 years on average, but as of October, almost 1 in 10 hadn't had a top-to-bottom check in at least 5 years. What's your assessment of the inspection problem?
Terry, thank you very much for having me on the program today. I think my initial reaction, and I have just skimmed the article, so I haven't been able to analyze it in depth, there definitely is truth in the fact that CMS, in its regulatory role, overseeing the quality of care in dialysis facilities, has not been able to perform as many surveys and therefore perform that type of oversight as well as it might like to have. We are hindered by funding that comes from Congress in order to perform regulatory oversight visits for all of the 17 different provider sites that CMS is charged with regulating and overseeing the quality of care. And the funding that is provided to the agency, on the one hand, is not insufficient to be able to meet the statutory requirements in terms of frequency and thoroughness of those site visits. This is further complicated by the fact that several years ago, many on the Hill felt that we needed to pay more attention to nursing homes than the other types of facilities, including dialysis units. So we were instructed and had to focus with annual visits to all nursing homes at the expense of other facilities, and dialysis facilities were, in fact, put on a lower priority track because of that sentiment from the Hill and the funding needs. So we have been not able to perform the oversight functions as frequently or as thoroughly as we might like to.
Do you agree with Robin Fields' assessments of the sanitary problems and infection problems at many of these dialysis clinics?
I believe that Robin's article, although pointing up some very important issues that this agency and the Department of Health and Human Services is aware of and trying its best to fix, that it overstates significantly the degree of the problem out in the real world. It makes it sound like any dialysis unit that a patient would walk into is subject to these problems, and that's simply not true. The vast, vast majority of the units are not as described in the several examples, which are completely true examples, but not illustrative of most dialysis units. I think my main quibble with the article is that it sounds as though one would not want to have dialysis in the United States. This is a life-saving treatment that the vast majority of people are being treated very well in very clean facilities that hopefully make very few mistakes. And the examples there are not indicative of most dialysis units.
One of Robin Fields' criticisms in her investigative article about dialysis centers is that they're largely run by technicians, and that the centers are legally required to have at least one nurse on the premises, and a doctor has to serve as medical director, but the doctor doesn't have to be on the premises all the time. So if something goes wrong, if there's a medical emergency, she says there isn't necessarily going to be the medical staff to take care of it.
Well, I think that over time there has been a tendency to using a fewer number of nurses and also using more technicians. This is not necessarily a compromise in the quality of care because the technicians are extremely well-trained, and the services that need to be performed for most aspects of the dialysis treatment are quite routine and certainly within the competence and skill set of a well-trained technician. The fact that there are registered nurses on site, they also are well-trained in terms of emergency interventions, et cetera. Historically, there have not been doctors on site full-time in any dialysis units for the most part. There may be exceptions where hospital-based units and others may have had an on-site medical physician. But generally, since the inception of the program, that has not been done. So I think the absence of an MD does not necessarily compromise the quality of care in the acute setting also.
So I know that some of the payment system is about to change, but Robin Fields, in her article about dialysis centers, writes that until now, the payment system had a couple of perverse incentives. For example, the government has allowed clinics to bill Medicare separately for certain medications, reimbursing them at a markup over what they paid the drug makers. So she said the doctors at clinics started prescribing more drugs for problems like anemia, and dialysis ended up becoming like the loss leader that got patients in the door so that the clinics could sell drugs at a markup. So that's going to be changed as of next year. But I'm wondering what you've learned about incentives and pricing, that lessons learned from what you've witnessed.
I think, Terry, we've learned across the Medicare program that the fee-for-service system provides perverse incentives. We, under fee-for-service, pay the more people do something or the more drug or service they provide, so that the agency for all payment systems is starting to revise those systems to incentivize higher quality care and to try to make the process more efficient.
How is it going to be changed in terms of the dialysis centers?
Again, as you described before, we were paying a base fee for the standard traditional dialysis services, but over the years, additional very expensive drugs were added to the treatment regimen, and these were paid for separately and with a fairly significant profit margin, if you will. Now we're going to take all of the services and all of the drugs, bundle it into a so-called bundled payment, so there'll be one payment that we determine is a reasonable amount of money for an average dialysis facility to be able to provide good care, and it will be up to the dialysis facilities to keep within that budget and provide care for that amount of money or less. And they won't be able to overprescribe drugs or overprescribe treatments because they won't be paid for those like before.
Is there a danger that they're going to underprescribe drugs because they'll save money that way, since there's just a standard fee that they're getting, no matter what the treatment is?
Yes, there's definitely that, and we're very concerned about that. So that in devising the bundled payment system that I described, we have monitoring metrics that we will be looking for underprescription of either drugs and or under utilization of the dialysis services, such as using too short a dialysis time. We'll be monitoring for that, and when we identify divergence for either underutilization or other quality of care concerns, we will be taking investigative undertakings to see what's going on. In addition, we are charged in 2012 with starting an end-stage renal disease quality improvement or quality incentive program where we give, we are actually going to be able to reduce up to 2% of the dialysis unit's reimbursement based on whether or not they provide certain services to meet certain quality metrics. And among those are a number of metrics that we've proposed in the first year that, in fact, look at situations where they might underprescribe. So it's looking at anemia management, which is largely dependent on a very expensive drug called Epogen. And we're also going to be looking at dialysis adequacy measures, so that if they're not dialyzing people long enough period of time, that would show up on those measures. And if they don't meet the prescribed metrics, we will be withholding some of their payment as a penalty.
Robin Fields, in her article, says that we pay more per dialysis patient in America than in other Western countries and other industrialized countries, and yet our mortality rate for patients on dialysis is higher. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that's consistent with the fact that for all medical services in the United States, we pay far more per capita than other developed countries in the healthcare world. And I think that's just indicative that in spite of efforts for the last decade to try to provide medicine and healthcare more efficiently, we're still haven't succeeded. There's still a tremendous amount of waste in the system where services that are not necessary are being provided, services that are more costly than others of equal benefit are being provided, and any number of other reasons. So this is consistent with the entire U.S. Healthcare system. I think, again, our payment reform the bundle payment reform that we're implementing January 1st, is going to go a long way towards addressing that issue, because providers will now have a very strong incentive to look at what they're providing and not spend money endlessly, but in fact to look at their expenditures and only give care that is absolutely necessary while avoiding negative effects and worsening care in doing so. So they're going to have to walk that tightrope and that balance.
Dr. Straub, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for having us on your show.
Dr. Barry Straub is the Chief Medical Officer of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. You can find links to Robin Fields' article investigating the quality of care at dialysis centers and the cost of treatment on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews last night's premiere of Conan O'Brien's new show on TBS. This is Fresh Air.
Fast food chains may have found a winning strategy for themselves. The Dallas Cowboys are struggling to find one. The team has now fired its head coach 8 games into a losing season. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
This was going to be the year, the first time in NFL history, that one of the teams in the Super Bowl got to play the game at home. In this case, the $1.2 billion stadium Cowboy fans called Jerry's World. It was all planned out here in Dallas. Tony Romo would hit tight end Jason Witten in the end zone for a touchdown. Rookie sensation Dez Bryant would scamper 68 yards on a punt return to glory. And linebacker DeMarcus Ware would flatten the opposing quarterback like a pancake as the Cowboys triumphed in Super Bowl 45. That was a Cowboys dream. This is owner Jerry Jones' reality.
A decision has been made to move forward with a new person in the head coaching position with the Dallas Cowboys. Jason Garrett has been named interim head coach, and he will replace Wade Phillips effective immediately.
In the first 8 games this year, the Cowboys have served up one of the most putrid seasons in franchise history. Quarterback Tony Romo is now out with a broken clavicle. That happened on Monday Night Football when a blitzing Giants linebacker crushed Romo while the clueless Cowboys stood watching. Even before Romo got hurt, the Cowboys couldn't score. They can't run the ball, and as Romo's unhappy fate demonstrates, Cowboy quarterbacks who drop back to pass take their lives in their own hands. Keith Whitmire is a reporter with Fox Sports Southwest and covers the team.
The offensive line got old quick. It was a veteran line. They thought they could get one more year out of this line, and it didn't happen. They can't run block, and they can't give their quarterbacks enough time for the receivers to get open.
As it slowly became clear the offense couldn't score points, the defense's morale began to suffer. Over the last 3 games, they've given up 41 points, 35 points, and Sunday night got beat 45-7 by the Green Bay Packers. This is the first time a Cowboy head coach has ever been fired midseason. In the locker room, the players were chagrined. Phillips was a popular coach who treated his players with respect. 6'4", 300-pound defensive tackle, Jay Ratliff.
I mean, I can't lie. I'm down, man. It's killing me, man. It eats me up inside. Can't really sleep. You know, feel, you know, sick to my stomach to think about it. But the only thing I know to do is just keep on fighting. That's what I'm going to do.
He'll be doing it now for Jason Garrett, the young offensive coordinator, now the interim head coach of the 1-7 Dallas Cowboys. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
The Federal Commission investigating the BP blowout in the Gulf of Mexico has laid out its preliminary narrative of the disaster. 11 men were killed last April on the Deepwater Horizon rig. The investigators are still finalizing their conclusions about what went wrong. In the meantime, as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the companies involved are still arguing over who's to blame.
If you're looking for one tidy explanation for the oil spill, you're sure to be disappointed. Commission co-chair Bob Graham says it's wise to consider the words of the federal panel that investigated the Columbia space shuttle disaster back in 2003.
Complex systems fail in complex ways.
The commission laid out a long list of things that went wrong in the Gulf. It starts with bad cement, followed by a bad test to see if the cement was holding. Then people on the rig missed warning signs that a blowout was imminent, and there are still major questions about how the last line of defense, the blowout preventer, behaved during the disaster. But with all this, the committee's chief staffer, a theatrical trial lawyer named Fred Bartlett, started out calling into question a widely held belief about the disaster, namely that BP cut corners to save time and money.
We've studied the hell out of this. We welcome anybody that gives us something we've missed, but we don't see a person or three people sitting there at a table considering safety and cost and giving up safety for cost. We have not seen that.
As Bartlett set out to pull the pieces of information into a single narrative, he found he mostly agreed with BP's own internal investigation. For example, the commission agrees with BP that the oil and gas came up through the middle of the pipe in the oil well, not up and around the sides. Representatives from the major companies involved in the disaster were called to testify at the hearing, and when they were asked if anyone disagreed about where the oil came up, the man from Halliburton spoke up.
My name is Richard Vargo. I'm the Gulf of Mexico cementing manager for the region, and I do disagree with the conclusion that's drawn.
Halliburton's view is that the oil and gas squeezed up along the outside of the pipe, and that was a result of a bad well design by BP, not because the cement job that Halliburton engineered was bad. Vargo's explanation about how the oil got outside the pipe was highly technical and apparently even confusing to the BP man testifying at the hearing, Mark Bly. Committee lawyer Bartlett asked Bly if he agreed with it.
You understand the point Mr. Vargo is making?
I could not follow the logic of his description.
As the afternoon wore on, they debated evidence for and against this and many other elements of the disaster. And the committee staff complained that they may never get to the bottom of some technical issues because certain senators blocked the commission's ability to issue subpoenas and gather testimony under oath. But William Riley, the other co-chairman of the commission, concluded that at heart it wasn't a technical problem. It was a human failing, an assumption that the problems involved in sinking this well through a mile of water and 2.5 miles of rock were all routine and manageable.
It's very difficult for me to conclude that there was not a culture of complacency affecting everything involved with this exercise, with this experience.
The commission continues hearing from experts today and has until mid-January to reach its final conclusions about the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.